Welcome back, folks. It's time for our New Orleans and Company segment, and Charlotte Voicy joins us, Executive Director of the Tales of the Cocktail Foundation, and the Tales of the Cocktail will start July 20th through the 25th. The home place will be at the Ritz-Carlton, and she's here to tell us all about what's going on. Charlotte, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Charlotte, I love the theme. Evolve, to emit, derive, educe, to produce by natural evolutionary processes, develop, work. Sounds kind of seductive.
It does when you put it like that. Yeah, evolve is the theme for Tales of the Cocktail this year, and it really speaks to how everything changes, right, for the cocktail industry, which Tales is at the heart of. Things change on a yearly basis, and the content, things that people can experience at Tales of the Cocktail, evolves every year, and that's no different this year.
One would think that it might be hard to do so, right? You know, people drink kind of the same thing, and then they try a few different things. But you guys have the level of creativity of craft cocktails and what's going on in that industry for the last 10 years has been second to none.
It really has. It blows my mind every year, but we continue to get 300-400 different seminar submissions, meaning talks about different aspects of drinking, spirits production, cocktail culture. And the other thing to keep in mind with Tales of the Cocktail, we're a global event. We have bartenders coming in from over 50 different countries, and you can imagine each one of those has different perspectives, different ideas, different cocktails that they want to share with us.
Yeah, we tried something that we had never tried. It's pretty straightforward. We just never tried it. We were in Croatia, and they a lot of the bars there were doing limoncello spritz as opposed to Aperol spritz. They did Aperol, too. And we started drinking the limoncello spritz. I'm not a big Aperol fan, but I did love the limoncello spritz, and it was an interesting drink.
You like that one? Yeah, I've seen that in Italy, too, unsurprisingly, where limoncello is from. But, yeah, I think that one's sweeping across Europe. So maybe we'll see it in New Orleans as well this summer.
Absolutely. So you guys have really become the event to go to as it relates to this industry. What are you expecting this year in numbers and so forth?
Yeah, we're really pleased with how ticket sales have gone. We've got a lot of over 400 events on the Tales calendar. The agenda's up live on the Tales of the Cocktail website, talesofthecocktail.org. And it's a combination of educational seminars, of unique spirit tastings, of spirited dining and drinking events, where my favorite part, where folks get to visit the bars and restaurants of New Orleans and have a special curated menu put on by visiting bartenders again from all over the world, and all sorts of different special events are on the calendar. So we've got a packed schedule, and ticket sales have been going well. We still have some available, so you can still hop online and pick up a ticket, especially if you're local coming in. But yeah, we've got a lot happening this year again at Tales of the Cocktail.
Every year there seems to be a country, a region that kind of comes up with new and exciting opportunities and drinks. Anything interesting this year from a different part of the world?
I think for this year, it's kind of a little bit of everything. For the Spirited Awards, for example, which is the Oscars of our industry, which we host on Thursday evening of Tales over at the Fillmore, it's a global awards program, and we're seeing more and more countries represented in the international categories. We're also seeing more and more cities within the U.S. represented within the domestic category. So it's really great. You know, maybe 10 years ago, you might say like London and New York sort of dominated everything, but we're really seeing a spread of recognition across the world and across the U.S. So I'd say rather than a specific country being featured this year, it's a little bit of everything, which is great because it only contributes to the diversity of perspectives.
Yeah, and I should point out, y'all typically have over 20,000 attendees each year. And as I look at the agenda, it's easy to understand why. I mean, you guys know how to, there is education, but you also know how to have a lot of fun. But what's new or different about this year's Tales of the Cocktail?
Well, the good thing is that the content every single year is different, right? The seminar topics are different. Spirits that show up are different. A lot of brands use Tales of the Cocktail to launch new products for the very first time, so attendees can come along and taste things for the very first time. Bartenders are continuously innovating, so you're tasting cocktails that you've never seen before, enjoying the experience from bar teams that might travel in. That you've never had before. So the program itself, the content is new every single year. And then specifically, you know, we introduce different events. For example, this year we're hosting a luxury summit for the very first time, honing in on the upper echelon of the industry, the sort of higher net worth consumer behavior, high-end spirits, understanding how that particular part of the industry works. So there's always a few new events dotted in, but every, you know, nothing's repeated at Tales. It's always a surprise and delight moment for guests.
Now, I did see in some of the literature that there's going to be new conversations around artificial intelligence. How is that going to impact this industry?
Yeah, and to answer that question, I'll probably be pulling up a chair in that seminar myself to understand. But this is obviously something you're always learning. This is something we see in every part of society, right? You turn on the television right. And the news is full of AI is infiltrating everything. So, yeah, what does that mean for our industry? Is there a role to play? And I think the better question is, how can we use it to help better the industry? And also understand some of the potential sort of dangers or watch outs. But yeah, that's one I've marked on my own schedule to attend and learn a little bit more about.
Now, I know you always love to hear from the attendees, and it's very important because y'all are always improving on the product that you're offering. What have you been hearing in the past several years from the attendees, with, you know, especially as New Orleans as the host city?
Yeah, I think, you know, people always love to share their experiences with Tales of the Cocktail. And that's, feedback is a gift. We truly need to understand that so that we can continue to deliver a world-class festival that's great for everyone in attendance. I think, you know, it's no surprise that people love coming to New Orleans for Tales of the Cocktail. Yes, they're coming for perhaps work purposes, for educational purposes, to network and meet friends. But the fact that it happens to be in such iconic, exciting, unique city helps a lot. So I know that people come and they like to engage with the community of New Orleans and the incredible music and food scene that you have to enjoy. So it's really important as well that we keep those ties with New Orleans. We've heard that from an international level and, of course, also a local level, because Tales of the Cocktail is part of the fabric of the community of New Orleans, especially in those summer months where it really helps boost the local economy.
So I think this is, what, your 17th year? Did I read that somewhere? Is that what it is?
I think we're past that. I think this might be year 21 for Tales of the Cocktail 20, now.
21?
Yeah. Missed a couple of in-person events during the pandemic, but we did continue our programming and connection online as everyone took to Zoom to stay connected during those crazy years. But yeah, I think we're coming up on 21 for this year.
In your wildest dreams, did you ever think it'd get this big?
No. Now, I wasn't at the first one. My first Tales was 2006, and it was relatively small. It was small enough that, you know, everyone fitted into one room and everyone kind of walked around and did the same things. You know, everyone went to the breakfast and then to the tasting and then to the seminar and to the evening dinner. Now, of course, it's, you know, divide and conquer. The agenda is a matrix of wonderful experiences. So in hindsight, it doesn't surprise me when you look at the explosion of cocktail culture and the popularity of going to bars and drinking. But 20 years ago, if you'd asked me, no, I couldn't have predicted this.
Industry analysts are saying consumption down. Is that something that concerns you, or has that been kind of the experience over the years, kind of the ebb and flow?
The way I see it is consumption patterns are shifting, right? They're different, much as you would expect as generations kind of start to flow through. The younger generation have different patterns and preferences of how they consume and what they consume. So certain categories or parts of the industry might be feeling those effects while others are booming. So it's really a balance, and it's important to understand kind of where the opportunities are, which speaks again to this luxury summit that we do, because we hear that while people might drink less, they're drinking better or they're more discerning with how they spend their money. In which case they might sort of save up for a special occasion or have one fantastic cocktail rather than a couple of average drinks. We're also seeing young people are looking into non-alcoholic options, some exclusively, sometimes alongside alcoholic options. So I think rather than consumption down, it's a case of consumption is shifting.
And you're right. That's a much better way of putting it, pardon my ignorance, but is this something like, you know, that you've experienced over the years, you know, as the boomers kind of the numbers are diminishing and now the millennials and then the, you know, Gen X, Gen Y, Gen Z. Do you anticipate this change or modification in the taste patterns in the future?
Yeah, I absolutely. I mean, that's part of why we chose that theme of evolve, right? We mm-hmm. want to evolve with the industry, with the guest, with the consumer at large. We want to keep pace with society and the changing opinions. We want to learn from the younger generation coming through who have new and creative ideas that perhaps aren't sort of married to the classics as much as an older generation might be. I think it's important to anticipate those changes and celebrate them, embrace them, be educated about them, and keep informed.
You know, you always kind of think of it in the classic, you know, kind of sense. You know, sommelier and as you're trained there in the classic wines, the classic vintages, the same kind of thing in cocktails. I'm wondering. Is there a huge difference, or do you notice a difference in the younger set bartender as opposed to middle age or someone who's a boomer?
I think, you know, I'm probably somewhere in the middle. When I was sort of coming up, the cocktails that I first learned how to make are sort of drastically out of fashion now, right? But that's my reference point. What I see mm-hmm. with a younger generation coming through is that the cocktails they started learning were new cocktails to me. So they have a different reference point coming up. So when they're sort of creating their own drinks, it's less rooted in the history of classic cocktail culture because they're not as close to that era. So in some ways, they have a freedom to be more creative because they don't have, they don't feel that pressure to kind of honor the classics. And I say that with all due respect. I think it's quite an exciting mindset. Yeah, but it's also good to have those older bartenders or the slightly older generation who do understand the classics and can kind of fill in those gaps. So I think we're in a really exciting moment now. And if you look at the demographics of Tales, we have attendees from all of those eras. And that's the beauty of coming together at Tales of the Cocktail, because it's the exchange of information. It's those conversations where you hear perspectives from, you know, maybe people quite older or quite younger than you that you don't often get to hear those perspectives. And that's where the magic happens and the ideas are exchanged. That's my favorite part.
Yeah. Interestingly, I guess it's all still about pleasing and satisfying the customer, right?
Of course, right? There's the old adage of the guest is always right. I don't know if they're always right. But at the end of the day, you know, we want to make people, that's what hospitality is all about, right? Someone walks into your bar or restaurant, you want to make sure they have a great experience. And the interesting part is that, you know, bartenders, much like sommeliers, are very passionate about what they do. So they're excited to educate. They want to show guests new things and sort of encourage them to try. But at the end of the day, it's really what the guest wants. right? So it's not a hard sell. It's about showing them options, giving them a little bit of knowledge. The more knowledge you have on something, perhaps the better you can enjoy it. And I think that's really at the heart of everything that we're trying to do.
Yeah, and I got to imagine that you must be encouraged and excited, too, by the diversity of the offerings. I mean, you know, with so many new types of things that are out there now, it's like, you know, we were involved in a conversation over the 4th of July weekend, and someone was mentioning, we had, you know, children with us, adult children with us, and they were mentioning a new drink, and I'm like, what are you talking? I never heard of this thing. You know, and sometimes you just kind of feel so out of touch, you know, because it's changing. It seems to be changing faster. I don't know. I may be wrong, but it just feels that way.
No, I think you're right. I think there's never been a more diverse offering, right, for the bartender to mix with, for the guests to order from. There's never been a more exciting time in mixology, in cocktail culture. Sort of, we went through this phase of bringing everything historic back, right, and uncovering all of these different spirits and liqueurs that were popular during Prohibition and pre-Prohibition, kind of bringing all of those back so that we can make classic cocktails again. And once that was done, it's like, all right, what's next? Let's create new things. Let's come up with, you know, new spirits. Let's bring to the fore different parts of the world who've been making these spirits for thousands of years, maybe that we've not heard of before, and let's bring those into, like, the common palate. So you're right. There's more diversity now than ever, and I certainly can't keep up, and I'm a professional in this space. But it is exciting. I think it's great, and it brings more people in.
Is there a little tinge of scary?
Yeah, it can be a little overwhelming, right? But again, that comes back to, like, a great bartender is all about service and hospitality and making guests feel welcome and not feeling, like, silly if they don't know what certain spirits are or don't understand the ingredients of a cocktail. Just breaking it down. It's like, you know, if you'd like a gin martini, maybe you'll like this cocktail that I've just created, and here's the difference, you know?
Yeah. So when you think about it in this context of changing diversity, where do you see Tales of the Cocktail in 5 to 10 years?
Yep. Looking to the future, you know, I see that we continue to support the global drinks industry. That's at the heart of the foundation's mission. We are a non-for-profit, and we're really here to support, advance, and educate the global drinks industry. So it's all about keeping pace with the issues that drive the industry. It's about anticipating the trends, making sure we're bringing some of those new and exciting ingredients and flavors to the fore, making sure that as new generations come into the industry, that they've got the right level of education and inspiration, more importantly, perhaps, to set them up for success so that they can go on and introduce the next kind of chapter of ideas and methodology and concepts for different bars, right? Because we've seen a lot of different styles of bars and restaurants as well come up over the last sort of 5 or 10 years. So I think the role of Tales is to keep pace with that, to anticipate, to provide for the industry what we can in order to drive that creativity and make sure that, you know, bars and restaurants remain successful, profitable, but fun for the guest.
Absolutely. And if folks want to learn more about the event, they can go to talesofthecocktail.org, right?
That's correct. Our full agenda for the week of Tales of the Cocktail is on the website. Tickets are also now on sale. There are still tickets left, so you can pick up a day pass or a week pass to attend some of our wonderful events. But all of the information is there on the website.
Yeah. And as always, we wish you the best of luck. Hopefully the weather will be great for the event, and it'll be July 20th. We know it's going to be warm, so
for sure.
Let's hope it's dry on July 20th through the 25th. We're going to try and get down there in the French Quarter and partake of some of the festivities, so we're looking forward to it. Looks like a lot of fun.
We'd love to see you down there. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us. And that's Charlotte Voice, the Executive Director of Tales of the Cocktail Foundation. As I said, July 20th, 25th, and it's the host hotel is the Ritz Carlton. We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Open Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. We're going to go open lines. We'd love to hear from you. We've been talking about a lot this week, so give us a shout and let us know what you're thinking. We'll be right back. Folks, just a reminder that you can listen to this show directly to your phone, absolutely free. Listen to Tommy, myself, Scoot, and others. It's easy. Just download the free Odyssey app today and take control. Or you can tell your smart speaker to play WWL. So you can listen to any of these shows. And we're also everywhere. You can listen to WWL anytime, anywhere. Local content on Odyssey, iHeartRadio, and TuneIn apps as well. A lot of folks listen to us at different times. You're not in the car, out and about, so it makes perfect sense. And, you know, we try, at least I do, I try to do certain things at certain times so that you know when is the best time for you, you know, to go and grab that. You know that I'm going to do a monologue every morning at 10, and if that's what you like to hear, you know that when you go back to the Odyssey app and rewind, you can go to the 10 clock hour, and you're going to have a monologue that'll be there. So it will be, we try to make it everything readily available for you in so many different fashions. So I wanted to talk about, you know, this Medicaid reform that I think there's been a lot of misinformation out there. Steve Scalise had joined Scoot yesterday, and it came up as it should. A lot of people don't really understand Medicaid, how it works, how it started out, who's it for, and everything else. You know, and what came out yesterday is that basically what is happening is spending in Medicaid was supposed to go, was supposed to be around 4% increase. Now, it has increased 60% since 2019. Yeah, do the math again. 60% since 2019. What they did in this bill was that they reduced that growth to 2%. So it's hard to call that a cut, because the amount of spending is still going up. It's not going down, right? But there are those that will mislead you and tell you that it's being cut. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office talked about this, and they said that over the next 10 years, the decade, which is how they come to that $1.1 or $1.3 trillion reform in Medicaid's over a 10-year period of time, Medicaid will grow by $200 billion over the next decade. So just as a reminder, Medicaid started in 1965, and it was a partnership between states and the federal government. This is managed by the state, funded by the federal government. It was a 50-50 deal at that point in time. And basically, it was set up to be the safety net for the country's poor and disabled. And that rocked along kind of in that fashion for a long, long time. There were some tweaks here, some nuances there that changed. But for the most part, they held pretty firm to that until around 2014 when Obamacare came in. And it expanded this entitlement to able-bodied, low-income individuals between the ages of 18 and 64. And the enticement for states, and this the mindset was trying to provide health insurance coverage for everyone. And the enticement for this was that the states would receive a 90% contribution from the federal government. So it rocks along, and what we're realizing is that this became incredibly expensive. And this there's been a lot of talk and chatter about how they're going to reform Medicaid, because at the path that it was on, it was very similar to Social Security. It wouldn't be able to support itself, and it was going to end up being too costly. So what H.R. 1 actually did was it's provided for a work requirement for single, able-bodied folks and recipients with children over the age of 13. And the requirement, the work requirement works as follows. 80 hours a month. That's 20 hours a week. And it can include community service or education. So it's not just work. Now, there's been any number of studies on this, right? And a lot of the studies are showing that there's about 40% of Medicaid enrollees right now are capable and able to work, but don't. So there's always been this rub between able-bodied and being able to work, and whether or not there should be a work requirement. SNAP benefits, for example, food stamps, there is a work requirement, right? There's also a cost-sharing provision that's in this bill. So recipients will need to pay $35 as a copay for a provider visit, a medical test, or treatment. The out-of-pocket cannot exceed 5% of a family's annual income. And there's also eligibility checks, because there are some people that work 6 months out of the year, depending on the nature of what they do. There are some occupations that have some very high-earning months. So they work those months, and then they don't work the other 6 months. Well, this bill also provides for a check, an eligibility check, instead of just once a year, twice a year. Now, there are those that believe that these checks are disincentive to folks signing up for Medicaid and receiving Medicaid benefits and the like. And they said it's very difficult. I've talked to folks that have had to do that. It's not. You can do it online. You can do it by mail. You can do it over the phone. You can do it any number of different ways. But you got to take ownership of it. I mean, it's like everything else. If you want a driver's license, you know, you got to go get it. There's nobody going to bring it to you at your home. There's any number of things that you have to do. And most of the people within this population, they have a driver's license. They have a cell phone. They figure out a way to get to that place and get that done and manage that as well. But when it comes to this benefit, we hear a lot of the human cry is that, oh, this population is not able to figure this out. They're not able to do that. Well, they're on it. They're on the plan. I'm sure they'll be able to figure out how to stay on the plan. You've heard me talk about these provider taxes and these what I call exotic financing schemes. And I know my friends in the healthcare industry don't like when I refer to it as well. I mean, I've been pretty consistent on this. Even as a hospital board member, we delayed our participation in this because I just never could get my head around how this was going to work and whether or not this was going to remain viable for a long time. My intuition said no, I was wrong. It's still around. In fact, the program has grown in popularity, but it's ended up shifting a lot of the costs from the states to the federal government, and now the states have very little money in the game, very little skin in the game. And this, some have referred to this as legalized fraud. So anyway, it drops the acceptable tax, the provider tax. And the way this works is I'm a provider. I pay a tax. And let just for argument's sake say that I pay $1,000 in that tax. And that goes to the state. The federal government is going to match the amount of money that the state, in getting that tax, provides in the Medicaid spend, whether it's 2 or 3 to 1. The state is going to get that money, and they're going to reward me for paying the tax. So in my reimbursement scheme, they're going to end up paying me more money than what I paid in the tax, guaranteed. So it's an incredible investment on the provider part, right? I can't lose money. So that's why everybody's a willing participant in this scheme, and that's why these numbers are going up exponentially, because we're figuring out more and better creative ways of how we can pay these taxes. And a lot of states have adopted a 6% tax. Well, this bill is going to drop that to a cap of 3.5%. Now, everybody said that this was going to hurt the rurals. And the reason it's going to hurt the rurals is that most states have never developed a financing scheme with state dollars only to provide rural health care. What we did in Louisiana, for example, we went to the major hospitals in major cities, and we would certify uncompensated care that would come into the ER, and we would certify that number to the state. The state would take that certification, roll it up to the federal government, and get a 2 or 3 to 1 match from the federal government. Would they give us the amount that we certified back? No, they'd keep that for themselves, and they would utilize that certification in order to fund rural health in Louisiana. If you went to our counterparts in Mississippi, they would get about 90% or 95% at one time of their certified uncompensated care number, and then the state would keep the rest. The state was still getting, you know, a plus up on their bogey. They were ahead. And at least the hospitals got some money in return for certifying the amount of uncompensated care that they gave so that their financials would be healthy. They would be able to continue to have a capital budget. They would be able to continue to buy equipment. So that's where this is. So that's going to change. And that's where everybody's saying that the rurals are going to suffer. And basically, it's because the states had figured out a way to shift the responsibility totally, in most cases, to the federal government. Remember what I told you. This program started in 1965. It was a 50-50 financial partnership. It moved away from that. And then when you added these exotic financing schemes on top, the state figured out a way to provide all of this and not have a lot of skin in the game any longer. And now they're used to it. And now they don't want to go back. And now that's why there's angst and anxiety, because they're going to be called upon to prioritize health care for the needy in their state. And unfortunately for us in Louisiana, we're in the top five of the highest states with Medicaid drawdown. I think we have over 30% of our population on Medicaid in the state of Louisiana. In this country, 25%, I think, is the number. 25% of the U.S. population, 83 million people are enrolled in Medicaid. And that's why these numbers are the way they are. And if we don't do something about it soon, we're going to be in another problem with Medicare and Social Security. And that trio will end up bankrupting us all. And meanwhile, the debt structure is going to go up in over $40, $50, $60 trillion if we don't get our hands around these expenditures. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. So there are a couple of texts that are coming in about weren't there some other cuts to this or otherwise, And the answer is no. I mean, it's going to be in that provider tax number of going from 6 to 3.5 on the provider tax that they send up to the federal government, and the federal government matched that and sends it back down. And that's where you're going to experience that. And there's a comment here along those lines and saying that a lot of the states are already strapped. Well, consider the following. You have a lot of the states that have decided to go to zero state income tax. And I would submit to you that the way that they're able to do that is a number of different ways, fine-tuning some of what they're doing within their own states, right, but also maximizing these programs like this Medicaid match with provider tax and otherwise to relieve them of that obligation. And then you have that benefit to the states. The problem that we have here is the friction and the change in the mentality of how this was ultimately set up. We've broadened the base. We've given it to more people. We've increased the income threshold in order to qualify. And, you know, without the work requirement, we have a situation that it's not as easy to move people off of Medicaid. It'd be interesting to see how many able-bodied people are actually on. It's hard to determine, right? And the same thing is hard to determine how many people are going to lose this. It's all conjecture. They're looking at 10 years down the road. The CBO has made some numbers of what's going to ultimately happen. But the fact of the matter is many of those people are not going to fulfill the work requirement, so they'll lose it, not fill out the necessary work paperwork, so they're not going to get it. And I know this by experience. Illegals are not entitled to it, so they won't get it. So the vast majority of those that will lose will be on their own accord, not because of any rules or changes in Medicaid. And that's kind of where this is all at. And that's where this misinformation, disinformation, smoke screens are being thrown up all over the place as to how this actually happens. So we're going to try and provide the most current information here as it relates to it. It happens to be a subject matter that I was embedded in for a long, long time. You know, I'd love to debate people that are talking about this that don't know the process, don't know how this works, don't know a whole lot about this. This has been a concerted effort of states to rid themselves of this expense item. And that's not how this was set up. And these things always come home to roost, and I say it all the time, math has no emotion. We'll be right back. Scoot joins us, and he's up next. What do we have coming up, Scoot?
All right, finally, the Saints have done it. I've been talking about this for a long time. A lot of other people have been talking about it, too. A new helmet. We'll talk about that and reflect on the Steve Scalise interview yesterday.
Scoot's up next. Stay tuned, folks. Hope you enjoyed today's show. Have a great Wednesday evening.